Right. Hello, everybody. I'm Robert Pickering. Welcome. I'm very pleased to be here in Poland, in Warsaw. Had a lovely time so far. Arrived on Saturday. It's been really nice to have spend some time in Poland. So I'm here to talk to you today about expression-oriented programming in F#. Now, this is going to kind of be an arm-wavy session, kind of philosophical, a bit like Scott Huntsman's before. If you want to see a more applied F# talk, I'll be doing one of those tomorrow, and so will a guy called Adam Gratz. So this is more about the philosophy of functional programming. It's going to be a lot like Scott Huntsman's session, just with less jokes and no animated GIFs. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start this talk by making a few assertions, and then I'm going to spend the rest of this talk trying to convince you that they're true. I think it's an interesting talk. We're going to talk about the details of programming, some very, very basic concepts, but we're going to talk about them in a deep way, which kind of makes it more of a 200 talk rather than a 100 talk. So this is the first assertion I'm going to make. Can everybody hear me okay? Because I'm noticing there's kind of a lot of echo. But can we all hear okay? Yep, okay. So programming is about data. I think this is, for me, this is the key to programming. But a lot of people have been fooled into thinking about it's all about APIs. It's not. It's about taking some data in one format, quite often stored in a database, text file, or other, and transform it into another format so it can be shown. Now, a lot of the way we do programming today, that gets lost in a sort of blizzard of API calls. But the important bit is the data and what happens to it, not the APIs that are called. The second assertion is that functional programming is not about programming without state. There's a lovely paper you can read by a guy called John Hughes called Why Functional Programming Matters. And this is one of the big themes of this paper, that to find out what functional programming is, there's no point looking at what it's not. You've got to look at what it is. So what is functional programming all about if it's not about programming without state? Now, I would say it is about describing the transformations between one state and another in a way that is composable. So we have state in functional programming. We just describe the transformations between them rather than making lots of API calls. And another thing we're going to talk about quite a lot is purity. Now, people tend to really overblow the idea of purity, like it's some great thing that you have to be a monk to achieve. That you know you have to spend all your time scrubbing your code so it can be as pure as possible. But in fact, it just reminds that your methods should rely on the data that's passed to them as parameters and nothing else. If you do that, it's a pure function. If you don't, then it's not a pure function. And the other thing we're going to talk about a lot is the devil being in the detail. So programming in the small versus programming in the large. Now, a good example of programming in the large is what Scott was talking about, saying, you know, okay, move everything to the cloud, get your architecture right, everything will be great. And while it's important to have a good overall design, how many projects have you seen which have had a sort of fairly sensible overall design, but they've still died a death because they were full of classes of thousands of lines of code? So the programming in the small is really getting the individual decisions you like right as you're writing each line of code, and that is what today's talk's about, not overall architecture. I think the programming in the small is something that's very, very important, and I think it's something that's not talked about enough about at conferences. So this is what I'm trying to do to rectify that. I also think it's a good idea to talk about why we need these changes. I mean, if everything's so great, why should we change what we're doing? And the reason is the software crisis, right? Now, this is something that was first identified in the 50s or 60s. I believe the first person to use the term in an academic paper was Frederick P. Brooks in his No Silver Bullets paper, but people were talking about it before that. And in this paper, Frederick identifies four aspects of the cost that make software hard, that make the software crisis. So we have complexity. I think we all know what that is. We deal with that every day, right? We have conformity. So this means lack of standardization. You want to do things on different machines. You're using different APIs. Despite the rise of JavaScript, you know, I think this is truer than ever. You know, all the different incompatible JavaScript libraries will still get you in the end. Changeability, I think that's, again, one that we can all understand. We're regularly asked to deal with changes from clients, partners, etc. Invisibility, so that's, you know, software's quite intangible. We've got better at doing this. We have debuggers that can help us understand what's going on, but, you know, it's still quite hard to see what's going on inside processes and things like that. So I think it's also valid to ask, you know, this has been going on since the 60s. Is it still true today? I think the software crisis has changed over the years. We're better at shipping on time. We're better at shipping features. But, you know, software is still full of bugs. It's not just because Scott's here today I'm talking about this, but he wrote this great post, Everything's Broken and Nobody's Upset, where he cited hundreds of bugs that happen in, you know, modern web apps like Gmail. And people are just very accepting of that because things are better than they are before, but they're still nowhere near perfect. Another big theme of this talk will be accidental complexity versus essential complexity. And this comes from another academic paper called Out of the Tar Pit by Ben Mosley and Peter Marks. And this builds on a lot of the Peter Brooks paper. So what they say, all those four challenges can be seen as different forms of complexity. But what they say is, what is important is accidental complexity versus essential complexity. Right, some essential complexity is some problems are hard. You know, if you're trying to do image recognition or something like that, then that's a hard problem. You're gonna have complexity. But a lot of the time in the software industry, we're actually trying to solve problems that are relatively simple. Data is stored in a database. We want to show it to a user, let them edit it, and then let them save them back to a database. And yet, we still have projects where that goes wrong, and that is because of accidental complexity. And something that really struck a chord with me in this paper is this. They talked about, have you tried turning it off on again? Because it's a cliche, because it works. But I mean, what I want to talk to you about is, why does that work? Why does turning something off and on again suddenly make it start working? And the reason is, when something goes wrong, it's because state of the application has been violated in some subtle way. And the only way to get back to a known good state is to wipe all that state away and start it over again. So basically, a lot of the accidental complexity comes down to holding too much state, which every so often needs to be wiped away again and starting off from a known good state. So what we can do to get rid of some of this accidental complexity is get rid of some of the state management, and your lives will be better. So here I wanted to talk about the three different types of application you'll write. So we have a command line app, a network daemon, or a Windows service, and a GUI app. Now, I think for the first one, it's fairly obvious that you don't need any working state. It's a process that's only going to live for a very short time. All you care about is the inputs produce the correct outputs. You input a file or some command line parameters, and it will produce you a file. You don't really care about the state of the process. What you care is about the outputs afterwards. Now, what you're going to say is, but for the other two, state is important. And yes, this is true. They do need to keep some state. But what I would say is applications like that keep far too much state. And to improve our software design, what we can do is try and minimize that. So for your long-running application, what you're probably going to have is a workflow that looks something like this. You'll have an event that comes in. For a GUI app, that's going to be a user pressing a key or clicking a button, something like that. Or for a network app, that's going to be a network packet arriving. And in the classical design, what you'll do is you'll read and write to your environment, i.e. Anything that's on the heap that isn't local to a thread. And at the end, you'll produce some result that will go back to the user or across the network, etc. Now, expression-oriented style is all about you do something very similar, but you just cut out all these reads and writes in the middle. Sorry, am I having trouble with my little pointer? Not used to one of these things. And what that's going to do is it's going to mean there's a lot less chance of your environment being corrupted. So a lot less need to restart over and over again. Now we get on to the sort of the meat of the talk, of talking about the different style of programming, expressions versus statements. So what are expressions and statements? So in a programming language, an expression is something that returns a value. So a programming language like C# has lots of things that are expressions. Constants are expressions. Any method that returns a value is an expression. But lots of things aren't, and statements are everything else that don't return values. And in functional programming, we only really work with these. So everything is, we only really work with expressions. So everything is returning a value. That is the key difference. So what do these differences look like in terms of code? So this is a typical statement-oriented way of doing things. The important bit is we want to extract an argument into a local variable. So what we do is we first declare up our local variable. We then make a check to see that our argument has arrived. And if it has arrived, we initialize the local variable. So that is C#. I mean, it could be Java or C++ or any other statement-oriented language with just minor alterations. And this is the expression-oriented way of doing things. This is F#. So what we have here, we make the same check. And this is F# returning it. It's because it's just in the return position. We return a value. And it binds up to this identifier. So there's no need to declare the identifier beforehand. It's all part of the same expression. And the other important bit is here, we're forced to say what happens if the input doesn't exist. We have to give it a value anyway. Otherwise, it wouldn't compile. So what you're probably thinking is that looks very similar to the ternary operator in C#, which indeed it does, and you can do exactly the same thing in C#, which is expression-oriented programming in C#, which is great. It's you know, ReSharper will tell you very often to refactor things like that into something more like that. That's great. So why bother with F#? It's because there's limits to what you can do in C# with that style. If, for example, you were wanting to do something a bit more complicated, declare a local identifier here, you can't do that with a ternary operator. But there's no problem declaring a new identifier in the scope and then calling another method on it, and then the value will be returned up and bound to the identifier before. And in the other case, we've still got, we're still sure that the identifier will be initialized. Okay, so that's all very simple, and there's probably not that much go wrong between that versus that. But when we start to get multiple arguments, there's much more chance that we could leave one of those uninitialized. Whereas if we do the expression-oriented style, what we're just going to do is return two values here, and here we're going to get type checking from the compiler that we're also returning two values to be bound to these two identifiers. So whereas if there was an else in this C# here, and we only initialized one identifier, you would get no warning from your compiler. Whereas in F#, the type system would do some work for us, and if we missed off this second string to be initialized, it would say, hey, you can't do that. You need to initialize both strings there. I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that with statement-oriented programming, the data is trapped inside the statement and needs to be pushed to a local somewhere else in the outside world. Local variables we were declaring were not part of the statement, they were just referenced by the statement. Whereas with an expression-oriented style, the identifiers are part of the expression. And to emphasize that part, we're going to go through a few more bits of syntax in C# and see the differences with F#. So this is the lock statement. It's fairly simple. I'm sure you all know it's for doing synchronization in C#. So what we do here, we declare a local variable. We have our lock statement here, and then our synchronization is protecting this collection. So we read an item from it, and we push it into this local variable we've declared. Now, in F#, not only is lock not a statement, it's not even built into the programming language. It's just a function in the library. And the function takes two things. It takes your synchronization object, as before, and it takes a function that will be protected. This is a lambda function in F#. So what we do, this lambda function returns a value, and that can be straight away bound to our identifier without the need to declare it separately. Another very similar case is the using statement in C#. So using is a very useful statement in C#. What it's going to do is, I'm sure are you all .NET devs here? Yeah? Okay. So you all know that at the end of this using scope, we'll call dispose on the connection there. At the end of this using scope, we'll call dispose to free up the resources. And that's good, except you're creating all these extra scopes. And the data that you want to extract from this is all the way over here. So, and you're binding your value here. So that's a bit inconvenient. Whereas in use in F# doesn't even create a new scope. We just have our use binding here. It's the same scope going forward. And when the end of this scope is reached, those will both be disposed as before. But we can just bind our data here after all that has taken place. So I guess what we're trying to say is that statement-oriented programming really emphasizes the reading and writing from variables, which creates coupling with the locations in memory that are being written and read from. Whereas the expression-oriented style emphasizes the actual calculations, and you're going to end up with a result which you can then just bind to something for use later on, or to be piped into another function, and we'll come to that later on in the presentation. So I just want to take a little aside to now go back to the things we were saying about purity and parameter passing. So this is a lovely quote from a blog post called Functional Programming in C++ by John Cormack. I'm sure you all know him as the guy that wrote Doom, etc., etc., etc. And it's a very good post. I don't agree with everything in it. It kind of does this whole big ramble about how functional programming is cool, but you can't possibly write in any other language than C++, so here's how to do it in C++. But one thing he does say that really stuck me is the process of refactoring towards purity involves decoupling the computation away from its environment. So remember what we were talking about earlier with the different designs. Which inevitably leads to more parameter passing, which is very true. But the designers of functional programming language have foreseen this and have put in ways to have less parameter passing. Okay, so parameters are obviously very important because if you really think about it, there's two ways to get data into a function or method. One, we can read it from somewhere, which is, as we said, bad because it makes your function impure. And we'll come on to the reasons that is bad later on. Or two, you can have it passed in as a parameter, which is good. But the problem with parameter passing is that, you know, it's kind of inconvenient. Even in F#, it is a problem if you have a function that takes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's not ideal. So what functional programming languages do is allow you to break things down into inner functions. So we have all these parameters declared up here. I mean, to be honest, you probably wouldn't want to pass 6 parameters into a method anyway. You'd probably want to wrap that up into a data type or something like that. But now all these parameters are available throughout this scope. So within these sub-functions, you can use all these parameters, no problem. You don't have to go on and pass them again. Now, in C#, you can since C# 2.0, you can use this style, but it doesn't tend to be the default style. What tends to be more the default style is we have a constructor that takes all our data. We read it all into the fields up here in the constructor. We unpack it. And then we have methods that will operate on this data that are held within this class. And that's, you know, that's a lot of work, sort of creating the constructor, reading out all the fields. It's more things that can go wrong. Essentially, under the hood, this will compile down to that. But here, you're having to do all the work manually. Also, functions provide better protection than private fields. So say you had some complex manipulation you wanted to do on an array. F# is not a pure completely pure functional programming language, unlike something like Haskell, so it does allow you to use arrays. And in my opinion, it allows you to use them in a sort of more safer way than a classic statement-oriented languages like C#. Because what you can do is, you can, if you want to do a lot of different operations on this array, declare one function that holds the array, break it down, the work down into lots of little sub-functions, and at the end, you can return your array, and you can be sure that nothing else is going to interfere with it. Now, again, the way that you would do that in C#, I mean, there are lots of different ways you could do that, but the classical way would be to have the array as a field, do some work on it in some member methods, and then return it to the outside world. Now, that could go okay, but there's lots of situations where that could get you into a lot of trouble. And the reason for that is it's very hard to reason about fields. Now, this situation would be fine if the client of this class immediately lets go of it and doesn't do anything else with it. But, which might be okay in V1 of the program, but somebody smart come along and say, oh, there's a big array here, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to cache this class so that we don't have to create that array all over again. Which might work fine for a while, or it might not, till somebody comes along and says, okay, a big array, don't want to create that multiple times, I'll put that in a global variable and let lots of threads have access to it, and that will very definitely go wrong. So, the problem with fields is, it's very hard to know what will happen later to a field. So a field could work okay in V1 of your program, but as things change over time, it's difficult to track whether that's going to stay local to a thread or whether that's going to be pushed to a global scope and be used by lots and lots of different threads, in which case that can get you into real trouble. Which brings me on nicely to the concept of scope. So basically, the larger the scope, the greater the potential for accidental complexity. And it just struck me today, actually, because I've given this talk a few times before, that this is the reason that singletons are bad, right? Because a lot of the time in software development, you get people saying, oh, singletons are bad. Well, why is that? Well, it's because they have a very large scope, so they can interact with lots of different things. I mean, singletons in C# are scoped to a certain extent. You know, you have to reference the assembly. You have to open the namespace. But after that, your code's free to manipulate them in any way they can, so that creates a great amount of coupling, and it all comes down to the fact that they have a huge scope. And the way, I just thought I'd try and go through the way that that's explained in the Out of the Tar Pit paper. What they say is you can think of scope as your environment. And your environment, really, memory, is just like a dictionary. You have addresses, which are the keys in the dictionary, and you have values, which are the values of the memory. So if you only pass two into this pure function, that's probably going to be all right, because you only have two values to deal with. That's very easy to be able to reason about. Perhaps the most important thing is being able to informally reason about how your code's going to work. That's something they put a great deal of emphasis on in that paper. But if we have an environment where we pass in hundreds of values, even if it's a pure function, we're not having any side effects on the environment, then it's still going to be very, very difficult to reason about what this this function does. So the greater the scope, the harder to reason about what your software does. And reasoning about what your software does is what programming is all about, in my opinion. So I just wanted to talk to you about a little bit about composability. Now, composability is, in many ways, it's just parameter passing. So we're going to show you a way in F-sharp how we would pass parameters from pipe them between a series of functions. So in F-sharp, this is how we create a sequence of 1 to 10. Hope that seems reasonably logical. Now, this could be one way we could implement a map and then a filter. So this is the link equivalent of select. We're going to make a transformation on this sequence, so square them all. And then we're going to do a where statement. It's just called filter in F-sharp to find all the squares that are greater than 3. So this syntax isn't that intuitive. Because basically this map expects this parameter here. But what we can do is rewrite it with this pipe forward operator where it's just going to take the parameter beforehand and a function and apply the parameter to the function. So everything will happen in reverse. So we start off with our items down here. We pipe them into this function so that we're first going to do a filter. And then we pipe them into this second function, so we're going to do a map. So these two are equivalent. They're just rewritten. And it's a lot like the dot syntax in C#. It's almost like calling a member method without it having to be a member. So the only difference is the parameter is appearing beforehand. Here the parameter is appearing afterwards. And so just that flipping things around makes things a lot more readable and composable. And so this is just this was just a toy example of that. And so I thought I'd show you an example from the wild. This is actually from the F-sharp compiler. It's the main function in the F-sharp compiler. It basically takes a load of parameters, including the command line arguments, etc. And then it pipes it through a series of different functions until out the other end you get an assembly. So people are really writing software like this in the real world. So I just wanted to take a moment to talk about testability, because people talk a lot about testability. And I think basically what it comes down to for me is that if you're programming in a pure style, you're going to get you're going to get a program that's very testable, because you can just put in some input, see if it gets some output. If you don't, what you're going to do is you're going to spend a lot of your time initializing all those dependencies. So the pure functional programming style can be seen as just minimizing all those dependencies, so you can really just focus on the thing that you're testing. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about the type systems again. We mentioned them earlier when we saw the F# type system gave you help to show whether or not your variables were initialized. So what is a type system? A type system basically just proves some property of your program is correct. And in .NET, that means that the type system guarantees you that a reference will either point to a valid instance of that type or null, which is good. You know, there's no more problems with accessing memory in the wrong way. But it does leave one bad thing open, which is, you know, the null reference exception. It's been called the sort of billion-dollar mistake by Alan Kay. Certainly in production applications that I've seen, they get a great number of null reference exceptions, and they can be quite tricky to track down. So how does the F-sharp change that? It tries its hardest to guarantee that a reference will always point to a valid type and not null. It does try very hard to do that by forcing you to initialize everything. I mean, if you really, really try, you can make a null reference exception in F#, but you have to try, whereas in C#, it's surprisingly easy to do. Okay, so that's it, folks. Just a few little summary points. So I've hopefully tried to show you that programming is all about data and the transformations applied to that data. We've talked about how software projects can be a death by a thousand cuts. You know, even if you start with a sensible design overall, you can still have a lot of problems with just having great big balls of mud. So accidental complexity and holding lots of working states can create some of those death by a thousand cuts problems. And expression-oriented programming can help you get into good habits of keeping state local to a thread, making things composable, and can help heal the wounds inflicted on you by statement-oriented programming. So I just wanted to talk to you about two books. Real World Functional Programming has been out for a while. It's by Thomas Petrick. It's really a very good read. He does a great job of comparing F# with C#, and it was a lot of an inspiration behind this talk. The other book is Understanding Functional Programming from Scott Wulshan, who also runs a blog, F# for Fun and Profit, which is really a very good read. So I'd recommend going away and looking at both of those. And also the Out of the Tar Pit paper, slightly less relevant to F#, but still got some good knowledge in it. So I work for a company called ITG. It used to be RFQ, we got bought out by ITG. We are looking for programmers. That's why my boss let me come here. So if you are interested, come and join us in Paris. And after that, are there any questions? So the question was, do I miss the kind of code organization of that C# and class-oriented programming brings you when doing F#? And I mean, the answer is not really. What you tend to find is if you write in a bigger project, you have a lot less code anyway, so there's less need to organize it. F# has its own way of organizing code around data types. I mean, you still create data types in F#, right? They can still have members, so that does help you organizing it. It is a different mindset with organizing code. It takes a bit of getting used to, but once you're used to it, you can still organize code as well in a functional project, if not better. It is a different mindset that takes getting used to, but you can still it still can be done. Yeah. So I mean, to go back to the real world example that I shown. So as I say, this comes from the F# compiler, which is written in F#. It's a big project. It has many more features than the C# compiler. You know, the Rosling team took 7 years to rewrite C# in C#. And they've still got a lot less features than F#. They have 10 programmers. F#'s like got 2, and they've managed to deliver more features. So Any other questions? So the question is, what is the main source of accidental complexity? I think it's very easy to start out with the first version correct. And then another programmer come along, reread the code, not understand what's going on, make some changes that introduce bugs. Another program will come along, misunderstand the cause for those bugs, will add more code to fix it. And you kind of see this growth of code, which adds more and more accidental complexity. Whereas what you should be aiming for is to reduce bugs in your code, to reduce your code base. Does that make sense? Any more questions? Okay, so I think lunch is being served. Hopefully see you tomorrow at my other talk, which will also be in this room.